This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guests on Off the Shelf are Jason Workmaster, partner at McKenna Long Aldridge, and Jack Horan, also a partner at McKenna Long and Aldridge. And today we're going to be small business, recent developments in small business contracting, particularly the Small Business Jobs Act of 2010 and its implementation. But first of all, Jason and Jack, welcome to the show. It's great to have you guys on.
Good to be back. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you, Roger.
Well, let's dive right into it. The Small Business Jobs Act of 2010, it's been quite a while since there's been a big piece of legislation, frankly, that sort of encompassed, small business opportunities and that sort of thing. And from your guys' perspective, looking at the procurement landscape and all the procurement provisions in the bill, what is significant about the act for small businesses and for the government?
Sure. And as you mentioned, Roger, this act, even though it's passed a couple of years ago now, is just now in the process of being implemented through regulation. And there's a number of aspects to it that are important for small businesses and for small business contracting with the government. And I guess I'd summarize by saying that it reflects two divergent thoughts within the government. They want there to be more small business subcontracting. They want there to be more opportunities for small business. It is called the Small Business Jobs Act, so as to create jobs for small businesses and to do so through government contracting. But at the same time, it also reflects concern in Congress that there's been misuse of the small business program. So at the same time that they're creating more opportunities for small businesses in the hopes of creating jobs, they're also cracking down on potential misrepresentations of small business status.
So we're really talking, Jack, here, like a carrot and stick approach with regard to what they're sort of giving more opportunity, or providing, not say giving, but providing, creating, trying to create a framework to provide more opportunities for small business, but they, at the same time, is to a certain extent, tightening rules about and the ramifications for companies who either misrepresent or are not really small at the time.
I think that's right, Roger. Another way of putting it is they're making sure that the small business opportunities are going to be retained by the small business. And what concerns me about it, and Jason, I think, is going to talk about this as well, is the stick part is really setting up small businesses, if they abuse the certification or the small business process, for some significant ramifications. It seems to me to be written for False Claims Act cases against small businesses who abuse the process.
Well, that could be a Small Business Jobs Act for lawyers, right? that we're talking about here. Jason, what are the new certification requirements, and what will they mean for prosecution of small business size misrepresentations?
Right, and what's happening with representations is that small businesses are going to be required to more often certify their status. So they're going to have to recertify their status as a small business yearly in ORCA. In addition to that, the carrot part of this is there's going to be more. The Small Business Jobs Act is going to make it more difficult for government agencies to bundle procurements. Which means take a number of small scopes of work and consolidate them into a larger scope of work. That's going to get more difficult, with the thought being that if we don't bundle as much, that means there's more opportunities out there for small business. So that means more proposals coming in. know, we were talking before we went on the air here about more of this happening within the context of the GSA schedules program. You know, so that we're going to see discretionary, more potentially use of discretionary set asides there. So what that all means is there's going to be more proposals coming in. And what this act says is that the mere submission of a proposal is going to be considered a willful representation of size status. And what the act says with regard to that is that the willful misrepresentation of status the damage associated with that is going to be the full value of the resulting contract. So again, the way this the way the system will now work, the small business is can either have liability because it miscertifies on that annual basis in ORCA, but more significantly perhaps, you know, every time they submit a proposal, you know, that's going to be a willful submission. And if their statement as to their size status is incorrect, that is a willful misrepresentation. And if the presumption is going to be that if they get the contract, the government has been damaged in the entirety of the amount. So again, what is, you know, practically speaking, what does that mean? You're a small business, or you get the work, you perform it completely. No question from the government or anybody else that the product or services delivered met the spec. They were good quality. Right. No question.
The government got value for it.
Did the work. But then, you know, along down the road, someone questions the small business representation. And what do you know? You're not going to, the small business, the defendant there is not going to be able to argue, well, hey, even if we did misrepresent that, you government got value, and you got to at least take into account the value you got. Under this statute, that's not the way it's going to work.
And Roger, from my point of view, having defended a False Claims Act case fairly often, it really removes two of the remaining defenses of False Claims Act case in these type of fraud cases if the government decides to proceed on a fraud basis. One of the defenses, of course, is that whatever the misrepresentation is wasn't intentional or reckless. Here you now have a statutory presumption of an intentional misrepresentation, and there's not a whole lot that can be done about that in the case. And then secondly, there's, I guess it comes in a number of ways in False Claims Act cases, but there's always the issue in those cases of how much the government's been damaged. And in these cases in particular, it's a normal damage theory. It's not clear at all that the government would have been damaged because they got what they've ordered. But now you have a statutory presumption, I guess, of damages of the full contract value. And as we all know, with treble damages being the measure of damages on False Claims Act case, that just makes for very, very...
So explain to the audience what treble damages are.
Sure,
that'd
Roger.
Be great.
That means you take the actual damages, and in this case, that would be the value of the contract, and times it by three. So you can see the significance to a small business here. And also, anyone familiar with this area, of course, there are the true intentional misrepresentations when a business knows it's not small but perhaps falsely certifies. But more often than not, you have situations where, because of the regulations that apply to determine whether a small business is small, there's room for mistake, you know, honest mistake. And here, even an honest mistake is going to have a presumption of an intentional misrepresentation. So it's a very difficult position for small businesses under the statute.
Well, yeah, isn't it fair to say, I mean, when you look at the SBA regulations, they're not exactly, you know, the examples of clarity, let's say, with regard to when there's a lot of areas for interpretation and judgment in those rules and how you apply them. And it seems to me, you know, that's ripe. Right?
Well,
for issues.
It is. And what's interesting here, as Jack was saying, Roger, you know, in the rest of the case law out there, you know, and there are court opinions that address the False Claims Act generally, not just, you know, not in the small business context necessarily, but more generally, you know, those cases have stood for the proposition that, yes, when we look at the contractor's supposed liability here, we look at things like, you know, did they have a reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous reg? You know, do we take into account, you know, there's been...
Jason, just a minute. We have to take into account that it's time for a break, but we'll pick up that thought when we come back. So right now we do have to take a break, but when we return, we'll be talking more with Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan, partners at McKenna Long, and we'll be talking more about misrepresentation, small business contracting programs, the risks to small businesses. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Government year-end is fast approaching. Look to GSA Advantage and the Han Company now and anytime you're challenged with a compressed time frame or to do more but spend less. Now more than 400 of Han's newest and top models are available online and at great manufacturer direct prices. You'll find multi-purpose chairs, smart desk solutions, durable storage cabinets, contemporary conference tables, and more to fit any office need. All meet or exceed government sustainability requirements, too. To shop Han Direct, go to gsaadvantage.gov and type Han's contract number 27F, like furniture, 0015S, like Sam, in the search bar. That's 27F0015S. When you need office furniture, GSA Advantage is a quick, safe way to buy online, and Han lets you stretch your budget without compromising quality or style. Buy Han Direct. Go to gsaadvantage.gov and search contract 27F0015S today.
Caps fans, there's more than one big game on Sunday. Don't miss the Sunday matinee against the Boston Bruins on Sunday, February 5th at 12:30 p.m. The Caps beat the Bruins 5-3 last week and look to do it again on Sunday. Caps games are always huge events. The fans are always pumped up. Always a great time. This is the hottest ticket in town. Tickets are very limited, so call 202-397-SEAT or log on to washingtoncaps.com/singleticks and do your part in building America's hockey capital.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
Powered by the latest second-generation Intel Xeon processors, new HP ProLiant G7 servers are a perfect high-speed solution for lowering costs, improving utilization, and reducing server sprawl. GovConnection, a federal elite HP partner, can show you how together they can power your data center into the future. Talk to GovConnection's experienced federal sales team, where service and commitment to the customer are priority one. Call 800-800-0019 today.
Dude, check out my new Pioneer DEH44 car stereo with built-in HD radio technology and new HD2 HD3 channels.
HD2 HD3 channels?
Get with it, man. HD2 HD3 channels are all these new free digital radio channels.
How do I listen to them?
With the new Pioneer DEH44 HD radio receiver. It's only $120 at Walmart.
Walmart? That's cool.
Yeah, just go to HDradio.com and check out the station guide. They're adding new channels all the time.
Learn about HD radio technology at HDradio.com. More radio, more value.
Meeting mission goals through IT modernization, brought to you by General Dynamics IT.
Several of the government's most recognizable websites are moving to the cloud. The General Services Administration has signed a deal to transition sites including USA.gov and data.gov to a privately hosted cloud platform. GSA made the award under its new blanket purchase agreement for cloud infrastructure as a service. It's the second such major deal under that BPA. Homeland Security used the vehicle to move several of its public websites to the cloud last summer.
General Dynamics IT delivers the full strength of enterprise IT to drive innovation like infrastructure consolidation and modernization, cross-domain information sharing, cloud computing, Web 2.0, and a constant flow of new applications and IT services. General Dynamics IT helps government, military, and commercial organizations achieve new levels of productivity and mission effectiveness. General Dynamics IT brings together the expertise, technology, and best practices to deliver secure enterprise IT solutions. Go to gdit.com to learn more. That's gdit.com.
America's top show about planning for retirement is on 1500 AM WFED. Sunday mornings at 8, it's the Financial Safari. Each week, America's income planner, Coach Pete DeRuta, sits down with father-daughter duo from Northern Virginia, retirement planners Don and Jill O'Rourke from O'Rourke Asset Management. Sunday mornings at 8, it's the Financial Safari on 1500 AM WFED.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, we are talking to Jack Horan and Jason Workmaster, partners at McKenna Long and Aldridge. And we're talking about recent developments in small business procurement, small business contracting rules. And when we had to break, Jason was just going to get into the nitty-gritty of some issues regarding misrepresentations and just the way, you know, the Jobs Act has sort of changed the playing field or tilted the playing field with regard to what's intentional or not and that sort of thing. Jason?
Yeah. And as I was beginning to say, the case law in this area and the False Claims Act case law, you know, has been headed, has been headed in the direction of, well, you know, yes, the contractor, the defendant in these cases can make the argument, you know, I had a reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous regulatory regime. You know, when you're looking at the damages, you've got to take into account the value that I provided the government. And, you know, those arguments, although they don't necessarily always win, they've certainly been, you know, recognized as legitimate arguments that should be taken into consideration by a jury. And what this statute is doing, it's taking those away. You know, as Jack was saying, you know, it's taking away a couple of arrows from the quiver that defendants have. And, you know, the thing that, you know, I would be thinking about, you know, if you're a contractor out there and you're not small, you know, what this means is that, you know, if Congress continues to legislate in this area, this kind of also gives us an indicator of where what Congress might do if the courts persist in saying that, you know, in this fraud area, you've got to take value into account and you've got to, take into account this ambiguous regulatory regime. You know, when Congress gets its hand on this stuff, you know, the trend has been, and this is consistent with the trend has been for Congress to make it harder on defendants in False Claims Act litigation, not easier. So, you know, this could be, you know.
So you're saying this could be like the canary in the mine here for the rest of government contractors?
Sure, because there's no limiting principle here. There's no logical reason that this should have to be restricted to small business. It could small business representations. It could apply to any representation, OCI representations, a whole bunches of other representations out there.
And another thing that's concerning to me about this, Roger, is this isn't a crystal clear area of regulations. Again, when you read these type of statutes, you're thinking of the situation where a large business knows it's not small and misrepresents, and no one would disagree that those cases should be prosecuted. But as we know who practice in the area, there's lots of other things that go into an accurate representation, like affiliation rules, the non-manufacturer rules, and the SBA itself has disagreements occasionally on whether a business qualifies as small between the regional office and the central office. So it's an area that is just fraught with risk for the small business even performing honestly.
Yeah, well, it seems to me from what you guys have described is if there's any question, you know, I'm looking at the regulations, I'm a small business, I've got my GSA schedule, I certified at the time I got my contract award that I was small, but I'm turned out to be pretty successful, right? And I see something that's been discretionarily set aside by an agency for a small business. I got to think, you know, if I've been successful and I'm growing and I, you know, under my schedule contract, even I've really got to think once, twice, three times before I decide whether I'm going to submit an offer on that, because the way the current rule reads is that they're applying the Part 19 eligibility requirements to anything that's set aside. So it's an added, you know, factor that may, you know, actually, hinder opportunities for small business. Frank, to me, is hinder opportunities for small business, not just provide opportunities for them. I mean, those people who aren't close, or anything that's gray, you have to think about whether you want to, what the risk you're taking, right? Am I right?
Yes, I think that is right. And at least in my experience, GSA small business set-asides or small business contracting under the GSA schedule is among the more ambiguous areas within small business as well, because you have GSA contracting officers who, prior to this statute, didn't apply the small business rules strictly to small business awards and small business set-asides. Things like the non-manufacturer rules were ignored for distributors, in my experience. So now you have, as I think you've indicated, the I think unanticipated consequence that at least under the GSA schedules, small businesses may be getting less opportunity for contract award while the contracting officers are applying now the small business rules.
Right, because that's a great point, because these contracts typically aren't set aside, the contract schedules themselves aren't set aside, there's no requirement to apply the limitation on subcontracting rule or ensure that it's a product of a small business, right? But once you start, you know, formally, I guess, setting aside things and consistent with the way the rule currently reads, all of a sudden those requirements now pop up at the order level. So you've got contracts and award on one basis, orders that are competed on another basis, and you probably have that small business who's competing for all kinds of other orders that aren't so restricted. So they've got to have, it seems to me, you know, the infrastructure to be able to manage and know which, you know, like which thing they're competing for that's set aside and what the rules would apply to that versus an open market, or I mean, not an open market, versus an order that's not set aside that they may win. I mean, it seems to me that it is going to be create some significant challenges for small businesses.
Well, and outside of the context of contracting directly with the government, you know, this kind of legislation and the SBA scrutiny of this issue, it's going to make large businesses much more nervous when they're subcontracting with small businesses. You know, I mean, if the large business is concerned that you know, in contracting with the small business entity, they might be getting themselves in the middle of a problem. You know, that's going to make large businesses more nervous. And also, you know, one other element of this, of the Small Business Jobs Act, you know, directly with respect to primes, is they're going to have a duty now to notify. You know, when a proposal goes in from a large business, you know, and they say, hey, here's our team and we're going to have all these subs and here's our small business plan, all that good stuff. You know, they're going to have to notify the contracting officer if a subcontract price is reduced to their subs, or payment is 90 days past due. So that's going to be an additional burden, compliance burden on primes. You know, and the government's also going to be looking at the prime subcontractor payment record and evaluating contract performance and past performance. So, you know, this large businesses, just because you're a large business, doesn't mean that this act and the government's interest in small business small business contracting isn't applicable to you. It's still highly applicable.
Right. Yeah. You're talking about the subcontracting rules that result of the Small Business Jobs Act. And, you know, I do, you know, it'll be interesting to see how those rules play out, because you raise issues of what are the costs to the prime contractor for, you know, complying with the new requirements. And, you know, the question that follows on that is, okay, will there be, you know, it's a cost benefit, obviously, if you're in business, it's a cost benefit analysis as to whether or not I use a particular team or not. And if there's increased cost associated, you know, administrative costs associated with using small businesses, you know, although well-intentioned, you know, will that actually reduce opportunity? It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Mm-hmm. It seems to me the other aspect of that is regard to subcontracting, and whether or not large businesses will say, hey, and what's the incentive? And I guess where I'm going to that is, I always saw one of the better incentives is the evaluation criteria. And, you know, that says, hey, what's your small business performance? What's your team? Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing, and evaluating that. But on the back end, you know, these administrative requirements, you know, I guess you're concerned about what that means for small business and primes.
Sure. I mean, it's one more compliance obligation. You know, and in this day and age, back to the false, you know, Jack and I have been talking a lot about the False Claims Act, but in this day and age, any non-compliance, you know, it's hard. You're hard pressed to think of a non-compliance that somebody out there would not assert gives rise to False Claims Act liability. So, you know, it just increases the risk for con. And one other thing with respect to
Well, Jason, right now, we do have to, again, I'm going to keep this pattern up the whole show. Jason's got a big point. He wants to make it. I'm going to take a break. No, but right now we do have to take a break. But when we return, we'll be talking more with Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan about small business subcontracting policies in particular. You know, want to ask Jack and Jason about what it means for primes. I think you're about to touch on that with regard to certifications of good faith efforts to subcontract, that sort of thing. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Government year-end is fast approaching. Look to GSA Advantage and the Hahn Company now and anytime you're challenged with a compressed time frame or to do more but spend less. Now more than 400 of Hahn's newest and top models are available online and at great manufacturer direct prices. You'll find multi-purpose chairs, smart desk solutions, durable storage cabinets, contemporary conference tables, and more to fit any office need. All meet or exceed government sustainability requirements, too. To shop Hahn Direct, go to gsaadvantage.gov and type Hahn's contract number 27F, like furniture, 0015S, like Sam, in the search bar. That's 27F0015S. When you need office furniture, GSA Advantage is a quick, safe way to buy online, and Hahn lets you stretch your budget without compromising quality or style. Buy Hahn Direct. Go to gsaadvantage.gov and search contract 27F0015S today.
Experience GW Basketball in one of D.C.'s best college venues, the Colonials Club. As a member of the Colonials Club, you will enjoy a game day atmosphere that is unmatched in Washington area college basketball. Your philanthropic donation and loyal support for GW Athletics provides countless opportunities to our student athletes in pursuit of both their academic and athletic goals. Call 202-994-7325 to join the Colonials Club today and help raise high the Buff and Blue.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does three decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time. But the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit capitalareafoodbank.org.
Hey man, what's up? Angie went to Walmart and got this cool Pioneer HD radio receiver, and now she's like, I don't know.
Simple stuff. Check out the buyer's guide at hdradio.com.
Cool buyer's guide. Oh, here's the Pioneer DEH-44, under $120 at Walmart. Angie, hip and smart.
See, dude, hdradio.com has the answers you need, and Walmart has the Pioneer with built-in HD radio technology you want. Now all you need to do is learn how to talk to girls.
Learn about HD radio technology at hdradio.com. More radio, more value.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
The Federal IT Challenge is a series exploring the administration's aim to fundamentally change how the federal government purchases and uses IT, and a discussion around one of the biggest goals, reducing the number of federal data centers by at least 40% by 2015. During the show, Doug Bourgeois, Vice President and Federal Chief Cloud Executive for VMware, commented.
Platform as a service is a critical layer in the cloud stack. Infrastructure as a service was only the first step towards the cloud. The platform enables agencies to develop, deploy, and use applications in more agile ways. It allows them to accelerate their time to value for mission applications and continue the savings journeys that they've already begun with their journey to infrastructure as a service in this difficult, constraining budget environment.
To hear the Federal IT Challenge in its entirety and learn more about the journey to cloud computing, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword VMware. That's federalnewsradio.com, keyword VMware.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit. Presented by NITP has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
Stopping blood flow from a wound can, of course, mean the difference between life and death. So a new sponge has been engineered to speed clotting. Even a neck wound that obviously can't take a tourniquet could be quickly sealed using the sponge, says Paula Hammond, a chemical engineer at MIT.
We can actually coat every pore of that sponge and therefore really load it with a large amount of thrombin.
The protein thrombin induces rapid blood clotting, and Hammond devised a way to spray it into the sponge in alternating thin layers with tannic acid, a natural substance found in teas that
interacts with the protein in a way that doesn't remove its activity and preserves it.
Hammond says the active ingredients remain stable in the sponge for at least a few months. To find out more about this and other engineering innovation stories, please go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jack Horan and Jason Workmaster, partners at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, here in Washington, D.C. And Jason, when we were taking a break, we were starting to talk a little bit more about this, you know, issue of small business subcontracting and, you know, what it means both for a large business when they have to make the representation that they'll make good faith efforts to subcontract with small businesses, and then the flip side as well with regard to when a large business is the subcontractor to a small prime. And I guess I'll let you tackle the first piece about, sure, you know, when a large makes that representation regarding good faith, and what does it mean from a liability perspective, and then I'll let Jack sort of handle the issue of when the prime is the sub.
Sure. I mean, it's again, I mean, when as we were talking during the break, you know, this requirement, this contractual commitment to make good faith efforts to meet a small business subcontracting plan, you know, it's been around for a good while, you know, but now that it's going to have the force of statute behind it, you know, it does increase, I think it increases from a practical perspective, it increases the chance that someone would assert an allegation against a prime that they're not making good faith efforts. And then when you're into the, if once that allegation has been made, either by a whistleblower or by an auditor, by a QTAM whistleblower, or a government auditor, you know, then immediately the large business is on the defensive. And so, you know, to prove good faith, you know, that would mean, you know, maintaining a good amount of records and, you know, having a program in place. And the cost of compliance there is going to be significant.
Right. I mean, they're supposed to have programs in place and do all the things,
sure,
anyway, but it seems to me it does raise the stakes. And I guess the way it could potentially play out is that if those stakes become too high, it's going to disincentivize, you know, large prime contractors, yeah, from using small businesses. It's safer that way, right?
It'll be safe. And then you're back into this conundrum that the prime will then have, you know, to get the contract up front. You were talking about evaluation criteria. You know, sometimes, you know, you'll get a solicitation where it says, we are going to evaluate you on your small business subcontracting plan. So, you know, to get the contract.
And your past performance.
Yeah, past performance. So the prime is going to be incentivized to promise, you know, we'll make good faith efforts to meet a very high goal. But by so promising, they're, you know, starting to fashion the noose that can hang them down the road. So it's just going to be a difficult, you know, they're going to have to balance that. They're going to be very careful in making that assessment pre-award.
You know, I just think it's never a dull moment in government contracting, right? I guess if you're one of those government contracting geeks like we are, right? So, Jack, and on the other issue, you know, what are the concerns if I'm a large business and I'm subcontracting to a small prime in this, you know, in this new framework?
Right. And one, before I get to that, Roger, one final point I think is, I mean, I'm recommending to large businesses and small business subcontracting plans to be more conservative now because of the possibility of higher scrutiny. They are goals and they're good faith efforts, but it just seems to me that you want your goals to be on the conservative side. Now,
makes sense to me. I mean, that's what I'd be telling them too.
And one other sort of general point, Roger, is that this isn't us seeing the sky falling here. Part of, I don't know if Jason mentioned this earlier, but part of the statutory language establishes a government-wide policy for prosecuting companies who misrepresent SI status. So Congress is basically setting the policy for DOJ and the agencies to assure compliance in this area. So there's little doubt in my mind it's going to get active in these areas.
Well, you're just doing, you know, what good lawyers will do. You identify the risks and what the issues are for your clients, and it's great. You know, I'm going to suck up for a moment. And it's great to have you on the show to talk about these things and just, you know, tease these things out. And and now, Jack, come on now, answer my question.
Okay,
business as a sub.
The risk for large businesses and subcontracts is, as you know, traditionally large businesses have subcontracted with small businesses, even in set-aside situations, under the subcontracting rules that permits some level of subcontracting.
Right.
Now you're going to have a situation where the small business, which typically has less of a pocket to pay damages,
right? And they're the prime
as the prime, subject to this new scrutiny and these new damages. And it seems obvious to me that the prime larger business is going to be looked at in that context as well. So you're going to have key TAM relators or government attorney saying, what did the large business know when this inaccurate misrepresentation occurred? Were they part of the inaccurate misrepresentation? And they'll be part of the case as well, and part of the scrutiny as well. And again, this is an area where the numerical rules are pretty easy to understand, but how they apply on particular contracts, especially with the ostensible subcontractor rule, is difficult, where there's room for honest mistake. So there's no doubt where the government is now establishing a policy to look hard at this area of government contracting, that it's going to spill over beyond the obvious and the immediately intended focus of the policy.
Right. So it sounds to me like you're, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but your advice to a large business who's going to do a subcontracting is, you know, you got to do your due diligence and understand what your role and performance is to ensure that you don't somehow, let's say, for lack of a better term, contribute to some sort of violation of a limitation on subcontracting clause and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I even recommend that they don't need to do this, but I even recommend that they, in their subcontract agreement, they make sure that they say that the prime contractor, the small business prime contractor, is represented to them. They've made accurate representations to the government.
Yeah.
So that it's obvious in the subcontractor agreement that the large business is relying on the prime contractor for the representation.
Yeah, because I agree with Jack, because again, it's kind of this tightrope. You want to do your due diligence, but you also want to maintain your arm's length relationship.
Right.
You don't want to.
That's right.
Because the more evidence you would generate that you're
that you're directly
involved in making their size status representation, the more you're really sticking your neck out.
Right, because the government will impute that all that knowledge to you, and like anything, you follow the money, right?
right.
They'll be looking at those large businesses.
That's right.
So just to sum this piece up, and again, I agree. You know, you don't want to paint a picture that the sky is falling. But that being said, you know, it seems to me you've sort of anticipate that how will these changes, you know, impact the interest of, you know, key TAM relators and the key TAM bar? It seems to me you're advocating sort of preventive medicine to try to ensure your clients are aware of this and take precautions.
That's right. I mean, as you know, there's sort of historical areas where key TAM, the key TAM bar and key TAM relators like to focus. It started with price. It went on to Trade Agreements Act and there are other areas. And I'm telling my clients that this is an area you want to be careful with, like you would be careful in those areas. Because it just seems to me that once the bar, key TAM bar, and a few successful key TAM cases are filed, this is a fertile ground, because you have the presumption of a false representation, and you have a presumption of the full value of the contract. Why not take a look at this area if you're a whistleblower or a QTAM attorney?
Yeah, well, you know, and hey, Jason, I'm not interrupting you this time. And Jack got actually finished his thought, so that's great. So, but right now we do have to take a break, but when we return for our last segment, we'll be talking more with Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan, partners at McKenna Long, and we'll be talking about some other developments in the small business contracting world. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Remembering what happened at the doctor's office should get easier if you get health care through any federal employee's plan. Participating insurers are putting a blue button on their websites that lets you download your medical history with one click. Depending on your insurer, you may have to enter the data yourself, but more sophisticated versions take it directly from doctor's offices. FEHB officials are asking insurers to include wellness reminders, appointments, medications, and lab results.
The beginning of another year is one of the best times to review the state of your financial affairs. Unfortunately, many individuals overlook one of the most important aspects of their financial plan, life insurance. WEPA, a nonprofit association, provides a free online protection quiz and needs analysis worksheet to help you determine if your family has the right amount of life insurance coverage. Visit waepa.org to learn more. Once again, that's waepa.org.
Hi, welcome to Best Buy. Can I help you?
Yeah, I've been learning about HD radio technology at HDradio.com, and I'd like to see what kind of HD radio receivers are available.
Easy answer. Here at Best Buy, we sell all kinds of HD radio receivers. Home, portables, car, boom boxes with iPod docking.
Cool. Are they expensive?
Nope. This Insignia portable HD radio player is only $49.99, and there's no subscription to listen to HD radio stations.
Sweet. Let's get started.
Learn about HD radio technology at HDradio.com. More radio, more value.
Your new Cocker Spaniel is waiting to meet you, and you don't have to travel very far. This weekend and almost every weekend, Oldies But Goodies Cocker Spaniel Rescue holds at least one adoption show in the greater D.C. area. Find out where we'll be this weekend by checking out CockerSpanielRescue.com. Stop by to meet the many homeless Cockers of all ages who are looking for their new home. These dogs have already been spayed or neutered and have all their shots. For more information on adoption, fostering, or volunteering, visit CockerSpanielRescue.com.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, nutrition, dietary supplements, herbal remedies, and more. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources at myvillagegreen.com. Visit Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda at 5415 West Cedar Lane.
My family struggled, and it was assumed that while I would go to college, I would have to pay for it myself.
Charlie wasn't sure how to get the money she needed for college. Then she found out about federal student aid and the FAFSA.
I don't think I quite realized what a huge deal actually graduating was. Federal student aid definitely made that happen.
Need help planning and paying for college? Find out more at college.gov.
My name is Charlie, and this is my story.
Arming your home security system gives you peace of mind, but are you paying $30, $40, $50 or more in monitoring fees? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems, the metro area's most trusted name in security, and pay just $18.95 a month. That's right, $18.95 a month, and no cost to switch. Don't have a system? Then Ackerman offers the latest technology, including wireless monitoring. Call by Wednesday and get 3 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service with Ackerman. Call 888-999-1070. AckermanSecurity.com.
Soon this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma, or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible.
March for Babies!
Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
Government financial managers are committed to produce timely, reliable, and useful financial information. Stay on top of issues that affect you at AGA's 10th Annual National Leadership Conference, February 16th and 18th at the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center. AGA's NLC features the latest tools and innovations to help agencies do their jobs more easily and more effectively. Don't miss it. Register today at agacgfm.org/NLC.
This is Mark Amtower. I've been advising contractors for almost 30 years, and when they need agency contacts, I always recommend Carroll's GovSearch. With over 350,000 contact listings and over 1,000 government organization charts, they help you find the people you need to reach in all levels of government. Give them a try. Get a free organization chart and a sample listing from their database. Contact Gordon Peel at 703-757-8228. Carroll Publishing, bringing government to you like no other.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan, partners at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP. And we've been talking about small business contracting and subcontracting and recent changes brought about, through the Small Business Jobs Act of 2010. And right now, let's turn a little bit to woman-owned small business regulations. Guys, what has happened in that area with regard to women-owned small business contracting?
Yep. In late 2010, and I guess they were implemented in 2011, the SBA finally got around to implementing regulations that, frankly, create a woman-owned small business program. Despite the fact that the contemplation of that program was occurred in the in 2000 in the Small Business Reauthorization Act of 2000. It's taken.
What was that again, Jack? 2000?
That's right. 2000. That wasn't a mistake. It's taken 11 years to have a workable program, or at least appears to be a workable program issued by the SBA. Now, in the SBA's defense, I think there was concern by the SBA that the program would be challenged under constitutional challenges as an impermissible preference. So they were working hard to get a program that was supportable and, in their view, defensible to those type of challenges.
Well, can you talk a little bit about what the rules look like for the Bush administration and how the current procedures differ from those of the Bush administration?
Sure. I mean, the Bush administration made an attempt in 2007 to implement the regulations for women-owned small businesses. And as I said, they were concerned about the SBA was concerned even then about the ability to defend the program against the constitutional challenge. So under the Bush administration, SBA did a study and concluded that four of the NAICS codes were underrepresented with women-owned small businesses. So the original implementation by the Bush administration was going to limit any set-aside for women-owned small businesses to four NAICS codes. That, not surprisingly, was challenged by the women-owned small business community, mm-hmm. and those implementing regulations were eventually abandoned. SBA did another study using different methodology and now concluded, I think the number is that 83 of the four-digit NAICS codes are underrepresented by women-owned small businesses. And that results in something like 300 six-digit codes. So it's been expanded significantly under this administration.
So what are the rules for qualification as a women-owned small business?
Yeah, Roger, I think it's probably most similar to the 8A program that we're familiar with. There are differences.
That makes sense, yeah.
But essentially for these 83 codes, contracting officers can set aside contracts for women-owned small businesses. And there's two levels of set-asides. For the codes within these 83 codes were historically women-owned small businesses have been substantially underrepresented, any woman-owned small business is eligible for a set-aside. For the codes within these 83 codes, and I think it pretty much divides down the middle between substantially underrepresented and underrepresented. But for the codes where women-owned small businesses are just underrepresented, The set-asides are limited to economically disadvantaged women-owned small businesses. So you need to prove your woman-owned small business or economically disadvantaged woman-owned small business to be eligible for the set-aside. You have to certify to that. And one difference in procedure the regulations require that I said, as I said, are different from other programs is the women-owned small business actually have to submit through an electronic system the documentation establishing for the contracting officer that they are indeed women-owned small businesses or economically disadvantaged women-owned small.
And they have to do it for each?
Yes,
for each
set-aside procurement.
Oh, wow.
And again, this may be a little bit of my cynicism and a little bit of the sky is falling, but that concerns me because that's just another whole area of misrepresentation.
Sure.
For these set-asides that the government could be looking at. So, go ahead.
When it's economically disadvantaged, do they have to sort of show that they're an 8A woman-owned?
There are economic standards. For women-owned small business, it has to be 51% unconditionally and directly owned by a U.S. Citizen woman. And the A women or a series of women have to exercise control of the board of directors, daily management, the highest position and compensation, and exercise the decision-making power for the business. So there's pretty strict requirements there.
Where the allegations come is on that daily management piece.
Yes.
You know, because the other stuff you can kind of take care of on paper.
Right. You can, I own this company.
I can show that. You can show the 51% ownership. But where the allegations tend to arise is, well, the woman isn't really running things on a day-to-day basis. That's normally where the issue is.
That's right. And the regulations, to make it even more complex and to give the audience a sense of how complex it can be in this area, the regulations specifically recognize that the woman doesn't necessarily have to have the technical expertise or the certification to run the business. A man could have that as long as the woman still proves that she's making the decision and has management and ownership control. So think about the ambiguity there. If it's an electrician business, an electrical business, now the man could have the certification as the electrician, but the woman can still
be careful there, Jay.
But you'd have the situation where a woman could still completely appropriate represent that it's a woman-owned small business as long as she has ownership management control.
So, guys, we're just getting to the end of the show, and if you wanted to sum it up and give one thought about how these rules are going to play out or what people should think about, I guess that's a better question, what people should think about as they approach these rules, give us your last second piece of advice.
Mine real quickly is women-owned small businesses should think about getting business because finally after 10 years they have the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely.
But like every other small business program, everyone should proceed carefully because it's an area that's ripe for enforcement. And at least for small businesses generally, Congress has said that they want to see government-wide enforcement of the rules.
Yeah. And it's just what we've been saying throughout, but with more opportunity just comes more responsibility on the part of contractors to make sure they're turning those square corners. We've talked about this, the pendulum swing all the time in government procurement, but we're still in an oversight pendulum swing, and it's not going to change unless the government wins the lottery. We're not going to see this change, and it's just going.
Doesn't the government run lotteries? That's not a good thought either, is it? Well, right now, I want to thank Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan, partners at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, for joining me today on the show. I'm Roger Waldron, and this is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition of Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.